Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
This is Sound and Vision from KEXP. I'm Emily Fox. Music has become an investment opportunity. Last month, we heard the news that Bob Dylan sold his songwriting catalog to Universal for more than $300 million. And since then, artists such as Neil Young and Shakira have sold the rights to their songs to an investment company called Hipgnosis. To understand what all this means for the music industry is Mark Hogan. He's senior staff writer for Pitchfork, who wrote an article last week titled "What to Know About Music's Copyright Gold Rush." And he says selling off rights to music to big companies is nothing new.
That's been going on for years and years. And really, even it being seen as an investment by some people has gone back to the 2000s. Some private equity funds were and pensions were kind of starting to get into it then.
So what does it mean for an artist when they sell off the rights to a song or they sell off their catalog to a company like Universal or Hipgnosis? Like, what does that mean ultimately for the artist?
Yeah, it's basically a quick infusion of cash for people who have, you know, really valuable songwriting catalogs.
But do they lose like any power, like to be able to use their songs or I guess have power over their own music? Do they lose any sense of power through the selling of a catalog or their song rights?
It depends on the specifics of the deal, I would say. Marik Mercuriadis, the head of Hipgnosis, assured me that, like, Neil Young, for example, who I think still has a stake in his songwriting catalog, that he would be able to say no to, you know, really bad ideas for uses for the songs. You would be giving up. I mean, if you sold your entire catalog, you'd be giving up control over it for sure.
You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, this idea of selling off catalogs or music rights has been happening, you know, for a little while now. But, you know, what are other companies out there outside of, you know, big labels such as Universal, Sony and Warner, or, you know, an investment company like Hipgnosis? What other companies are seeing music as an investment opportunity that are trying to kind of buy into this idea of music as an investment?
Sure. Well, I should probably back up at some point and just make clear that there's, you know, a whole bunch of different copyrights on music. So we're talking about the songwriting side. There's also a whole separate set of copyrights for the what's called the sound recording or the master. And then even just on the songwriting side, it gets split up between like the songwriter and a publisher. So a lot of the people that have been buying songwriting copyrights are these publishing companies. So the big three are, you know, we mentioned Universal already, but there's also Warner Chappell, and Sony ATV. And then there's been, you know, other publishers getting into the mix over recent years: Concord Music Group, Downtown Music Publishing, Cobalt Music Group. A newer one that's been one of the more aggressive buyers is Primary Wave. And then, yeah, you've got like these investment types who've been getting into it that aren't, you know, music businesses so much. These private equity firms, pension funds, and then Hipgnosis is actually like a publicly listed fund that anybody can invest in. So I guess all those, like, you know, GameStop guys on Reddit are going to, you know, be getting into the song market now. I don't know.
But Hipgnosis, they basically, like, is their fund mostly buying music? And if you were to, like, buy stock in Hipgnosis, are you basically buying stock in music? Like, is that how that company works?
That's a good question. So yeah, if you're buying stock in Hipgnosis, like, you're buying stock in Hipgnosis. It's a publicly company, but like what they do, it's a publicly traded company, but like what they do is they buy up catalogs. So you'd be buying stock in them sort of like any other kind of publicly traded investment vehicle where, you know, their price could go up or down, like their dividends that they give to you could go up or down. But, you know, their income, you know, their revenues are based on what they make from all these songs they buy. And their founder, this guy Merck, who I talked with for a while, I mean, he seems like he's a former artist manager as well as a record executive. So I think he's kind of this bridge between, like, he knows how to talk to people who love music like us. He knows how to talk to artists. And then he also speaks this whole financial language. So, yeah, he was kind of an interesting character with a really ambitious idea.
So you say in your Pitchfork article, when you talked to Hymnosa's founder, you know, he basically said, you know, where the big three publishers use their legacy catalogs to underwrite the costs of gambling on fresh talent, he says he finds that completely illogical. He explains, quote, why would you spend your time trying to create something new at the expense of your catalog when your catalog is already filled with songs that people know and love and have demand for? And so basically he's saying, like, we are only looking for legacy artists. They're the only ones that can make us money. But if that's his mentality, I'm curious, like, what a company like Hymnosa means for the music industry as a whole. I mean, when we think of so much of the music industry as independent musicians, you know, up and coming musicians, you know, not a lot of people make it to that top tier that Hymnosa is after. And so what impact do you think a company like Hymnosa or the mentality that, you know, only this top echelon that's already have proven hits matters, what kind of impact do you think that could mean for the music industry?
Yeah, when I read him say that and then when I heard him say that, it definitely made me think about, well, okay, like, so the major labels, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of major labels here, but, like, if they're at least putting that money back into new music, that seems to me like a good thing. And then I definitely got concerned that if there's all these people swooping in and spending all this money on what's just these, already these proven hits, then where, you know, what money does that leave for up-and-coming talent? And I think that is an open question. I mean, I think that the big investors that are trying to make money off of old songs are not really worried about music the way that we are, you know, it's that's not their focus. They're trying to make money, and, you know, let's not be just totally romantic about it. Like, people are trying to make money from music, but yeah, I think that there's a windfall going to Wall Street, but, like, it's not necessarily doing anything to benefit the broader music ecosystem.
And I wonder, like, you know, when we think about, like, politics in our country, we're becoming more divided. And I'm thinking about the music industry, too. Like, is the music industry becoming so divided? Because, like, on one hand, we're talking about, you know, companies buying out catalogs or song rights from these top tier artists. And those top tier artists, like, already got a bunch of money from album sales back in the day before streaming. And so they already, you know, benefited from that era of the music industry where an album sale actually really meant something in terms of, you know, your finances. And those artists are now getting, like, a second wave of listeners through the streaming era, you know, many folks who maybe have already bought their physical copy of their album back in the late 90s or whatever it may be, you know, so it's like these older artists continue to make more and more money, but, you know, then the independent artists, they're getting less and less opportunity to even make money. You know, we're not touring right now, but, you know, the fact that they entered during the streaming era, I wonder if that's just going to create this even larger divide within the music industry in terms of at what point do you actually start making money for music?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that really worries me. I mean, and you think about those classic rock acts. I mean, they sold LPs in the 60s and then they got to resell everything to everybody in the 90s on CD. And then, you know, yeah, they're not selling stuff anymore, but they can sell off their catalogs and make money that way. And then for up and coming artists, there aren't those roots. And I think we're realizing that, you know, now that touring is gone, that we're starting to see how streaming is not really covering it either. And luckily, I mean, there are some ways that people can buy, you know, records, but it's just not as big as it used to be. And this is maybe sort of another, this might be a tangent, but somebody emailed me after the article came out and they talked about how another factor here is that interest rates are really low, which was definitely a little bit more, like, financy than I wanted to get into in the article. But, like, if interest rates go up, then, like, these Wall Street types are going to be able to get their money from just, like, what they are used to investing in, like bonds and stuff. And they're not necessarily going to have to go for, like, riskier things like songs. So this could be a bit of a bubble that might not last forever. The prices being so high, I guess we'll see. Obviously they're betting that these are valuable. So.
Interesting. I mean, overall, while writing this article for Pitchfork, you know, again, it's titled What to Know About Music's Copyright Gold Rush. What did you find most fascinating along the way? Did you feel like you learned anything new, or did something, like, really stick with you when you were writing this article?
What I was really interested in was, okay, what does this actually mean for people who love music? And one of the things that I found out was, well, I mean, I was asking people, you know, are we going to suddenly start hearing these songs more in playlists or on TV shows? And I was kind of surprised that at least the line seems to be that, well, no, this is, you know, you're not going to have these massively be exploited right away. Exploited is one of the words that they use, by the way. I'm not a big fan of that word, but I think it's maybe legally accurate. But I was talking to Larry Mestel, who is the head of this company, Primary Wave, that's been buying up a lot of catalogs. They actually just bought up the assets of Sun Records also. And he was kind of talking about these deeper ways that they want to use these catalogs. That they've got like a Whitney Houston biopic in the works with the guy who wrote the film Bohemian Rhapsody. That they made a holiday for Smokey Robinson. They've got like a show in Vegas for Bob Marley with a company that's done all these Olympic Games opening and closing ceremonies. And so that kind of struck me. That's just like, wow, this is bigger than what I was thinking about. Just like, we're going to get your songs in playlists. It's like they're really going to make these songwriting catalogs be part of the culture in a big way.
I mean, for you, what is the big takeaway? Like, what do you think all this means, this copyright situation means for where the industry is now, music industry is now, and where it's going?
That's a great question. And yeah, I guess obviously I fret about there not being enough money to fund actual new creative music if it's all being spent on, you know, again, I love Smokey Robinson, but like maybe we don't need to, you know, maybe he's not, spending on his catalog is not really my priority right now as somebody who writes about and loves music. A big kind of question I was left with at the end of the piece that I feel like I probably didn't get to fully probe the Hypnosis founder on in the interview because there's only so much time, but you know, he was talking about who he thinks are going to be the most important artists of this entire century. And he's talking about Justin Bieber, Ed Sheeran, Beyonce, all these, you know, huge celebrities, which may or may not be true. But then I was thinking, well, okay, you're talking about how your company owns these copyrights for like 70 to 100 years. I think 101 years, they said, was the average that they have this copyright protection over these songs. And, you know, thinking back through all these technological changes, you know, I mean, we already talked about vinyl LPs and CDs, but like, you know, and then there was Napster, and then and now we're on streaming. But like, if you go back to the 1930s, they weren't even listening to vinyl yet. They're listening to shellac 78s. And like, I actually said to him, well, you know, what do you listen to from the 30s? And he gave me a good answer. But one of the answers was Robert Johnson, this like famously overlooked, you know, blues trailblazer. And can these guys, like, can some business executive just really foresee like who the next Robert Johnson is going to be? I mean, if you're standing here today saying, oh, I think Ed Sheeran is going to be culturally significant in 100 years, I mean, maybe, but like, I think there's a pretty good chance that there's somebody brilliant out there that we're not supporting enough. And so yeah, I guess that was my kind of suspicion that I can't prove, but that was kind of my concern coming out of it all.
That was my conversation with Mark Hogan, senior staff writer at Pitchfork, who wrote an article last week titled, What to Know About Music's Copyright Gold Rush. And that was Sound and Vision. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, subscribe to it, rate it, and review it. As you probably know, the podcast marketplace is very saturated. So if you're not a celebrity or you don't have a massive marketing campaign to back your show, it's really hard for people to find out about your podcast. And you can help spread the word by, again, telling other people about it, subscribing, rating, or reviewing the show. Because, by the way, KEXP is a nonprofit, publicly funded radio station based in Seattle. And so we encourage people to give to the station. That's how we're funded. So you can give to this podcast. You can give a one-time $20 donation to help support this show. You can give at kexp.org/sound. But most of all, thanks for listening.